Great to have you with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, I'm Larry Mueller, and really pleased to have back Melinda Myers, Milwaukee-based garden expert, author of more than 20 books on gardening. Always fun to have her along, and certainly I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. You can reach us with your gardening question at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at talk@wpr.org. And a lot of people have already posted on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show with questions and actually some photos as well. So we'll try and work through those as we go along today in the show. Melinda with us by phone. Hi, Melinda. Thanks for taking time to be with us today.
Always a pleasure, Larry. It's great. And I'm feeling very technologically either savvy or be humble after the end of trying to do Facebook and look at these pictures. And what a great idea. And hopefully I can make it work on my end.
I hope you can, too. Well, have you had a chance to look at any of the pictures?
Well, I'm on your Facebook, so I'm looking at them, but I'm not seeing the post related to this show. So, maybe I need to go to most recent. Maybe that.
Yeah, that might do
it. Look at you. You're good. I do listen to the computer guys. Yes, I'm here now. Okay. Yay. All right.
Well, I tell you what, we have lots of questions on board, but how's your garden looking? Mine's looking great.
Mine's looking good. I got a late start. You know, when you're in the business, you're telling everyone else what to do before you ever get to your yard.
Yeah.
And so my containers are really popping. I feel like a lot of us, you know, summer finally arrived fast and furious, but this recent heat's been great, and it's dry in a lot of parts of the state, including my neck of the woods. So if we don't get some rain soon, I think we got so much early in the season, it's so easy to forget that, you know, keep an eye on that moisture situation, and water thoroughly is needed.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't know if you've had a chance to look at one of the photos on the Facebook page, the one from Amy.
Yes.
Who says, I have something eating all the leaves off my knockout roses, 3 out of 4 so far. Any suggestions on what could be doing that?
Yeah, a couple things that I always look for, and usually in June and a little later this year, towards the end of June and early July, we had a lot of problems with rose slugs, and they're translucent. They're not slugs. They're really caterpillars, and usually they eat the upper surface, and then it leaves it kind of almost from a distance. The leaves look brown, and as they continue to feed, you'll get large holes like we're seeing there. Japanese beetles are out. But those are insects that you see because they eat and mate in broad daylight. There's no missing those babies. And they kind of give that skeletonized look, too. And then there are some other caterpillars that will also take out the big holes like I'm seeing in the picture in Amy's leaves. So what I would recommend she do is go out about dusk, look under the leaves and along the stems, and see if she can find any signs of insects. The other thing is, the good news is the caterpillars can be treated with soap, which is very, you know, eco-friendly. Yep. The soft flies, and then you can also use Bacillus thuringiensis on those. The soft flies, usually by now, they're about done feeding. So if there are any remaining, they're probably just finishing up, and they're going to be gone soon. So really not worth breaking out the soap. It may help irritate them enough to get them to stop eating and leave. So there's some great sense of revenge in that. So, Amy, take a look a little bit later in the day. Check that out. The good news is we've got a good portion of the growing season left to get some new leaves out that'll mask that damage. If you do find Japanese beetles, I know you've talked about it before, but I'm a big fan. I do what Old Brook Botanic Garden does, is they just send out volunteers and staff with cans of soapy water, knock those beetles in the cans. Early in the day, they tend to congregate, so you can get a lot of them with one fell swoop, and usually have pretty decent luck at keeping them under control.
You know, we were, just as an aside, we were at the, my wife and I and daughter were at the Old Brick Botanical Gardens just a couple of days ago, and the gardens are just looking gorgeous.
Oh, that is one of my favorite places. Wisconsin has so many wonderful gardens, you know, Green Bay, Berner Botanical Gardens, Old Brook, Janesville, and I apologize for leaving any out, but, you know, what a great place to go, relax, enjoy, get some ideas. I'll be hosting my summer garden walk at Berner Botanical Gardens, so if you can join me, it's this Wednesday, coming Wednesday, but I also do it virtually, so you can go to my website, check out the handout and the pictures. You'll find a lot of those plants at other botanic gardens. A little bit of information, photos to help you, and hopefully give you some ideas and inspiration for your yard as well.
We had one, as long as we're still on the Facebook page, Amy had a picture of a tree with berries that resemble blackberries. Can you tell me what kind of tree it could be and if the berries are edible?
These are mulberries, and anybody that's grown mulberries knows that the birds love them as much as people do. They are edible. The birds will eat them and distribute the seeds everywhere.
Yes.
When people used to hang their laundry out, everyone hung their laundry out. If there was a mulberry tree nearby, the sheets would always have a little bit of mulberry stain on them, it seemed. I have them growing in my alley because the park across the way has a mulberry, so the birds kind of distribute them. They are edible. They're kind of a messy tree if you can't keep after the cleanup part, but you know, I have a couple of friends that love to forage off the landscape, and mulberries are one of their favorites. So you can eat them. The birds love them. And just realize before you plant one that you'll be doing a little weeding and cleanup once they start bearing fruit.
Shirley and Prentice has a question for you. So let's go there. Hi, Shirley. Thanks for calling.
Oh, you're welcome, Larry. Thank you. I've been trying to find a floating roll cover. I've never seen one. I don't know what the advantage is of using them, and maybe you can tell me something about that.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of floating row covers. They're sold by the names of Remay, capital R-E-E, capital M-A-Y. Usually see that in garden catalogs and some garden centers. Also sold as Harvest Guard.
It's another one.
And then there's also, and that's kind of in a, like a 5 foot wide, I think it's 30 foot long piece. And then also sold in a more of a square piece as Grass Fast, either in white or green, because that one's typically used when you're planting grass seed. But I like that when I get the white one because it's a bigger area, and I just find, for me, it allows me to cover plants a lot easier. The idea of floating row covers is they let air, light, and water through but trap heat around the plants. So in years like this when our springs are so cool, or if you like to jumpstart the season, it's a great way to get your plants out early, keep them protected from the frost, and also extend the season on the other end, protect your plants in the fall. I like it because you don't have to construct anything. You just lay it over loosely on the plants, leave enough slack for the plants to grow, anchor it with boards or stones or little wire wickets you can make or buy. That's all you do. You can reuse it as long as it doesn't rip and tear. So mine starts out big and then usually
gets smaller.
Yes, exactly. But you know, then I can get a lot of use out of it a couple of years. The other thing you can use it for is for preventing insect damage. Now, things like cabbage, where you've got the white moths flying around laying their eggs on your broccoli, Brussels sprouts, and cabbage, covering them with row cover, the insects can't lay their eggs on it, so you prevent the damage. I like to seed radishes in between my cabbages, and I've used that, and then that's prevented the root maggot that often hits the radishes. So it's a wonderful benefit. Things like cucumber beetles, the reason we control those is because they carry bacteria. Now, obviously, with cucumbers and squash, you have to uncover the plants when they start flowering because the bees need to get in and pollinate. But there's been some work out of, I was reading something the other day from Colorado, I think it was, or Connecticut, where they found if they covered the squash, the other vine crops that have problems with the cucumber beetle, until they start blooming, that they're able to really greatly reduce the amount of problems with bacterial wilt. You know, it doesn't eliminate it, but usually they
cuts
find
it back.
Yeah, sets it back. The beetles are hopefully going somewhere else to munch, and a much easier way to, you know, a chemical-free way to manage those insects. So really useful tool. It's been around a long time. I'm starting to see more and more garden centers starting to carry it again.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Shirley, for calling. Appreciate your call. Karen in Green Bay, we're on to you now. Hi, Karen.
Hi.
Thanks for calling.
How can I help?
I have an overabundance of rabbits, chipmunks, and squirrels in my yard this year. More than the last couple years. I've only lived in the neighborhood for a couple years, but I've had a neighbor tell me recently that even with a fence around her green beans, she couldn't keep the rabbits out. So I'm going to give up on green beans. But I planted eggplant last year, and they didn't bother it. Now this year, I recently planted some eggplant in late, and they looked very nice, and now all six plants have been clipped off. by one of those creatures. They've also eaten a lot of my flowers this year, more so than last year. I wonder if there's any advice you can give me besides I've been spraying Animal Stopper on, but then, of course, as soon as it rains, you have to do it again.
Right.
Any other suggestions? We were gone for 3 days, and it rained a lot while we were gone, and they totally took off the top of my broccoli because I had it in cartons, milk cartons type things, and what grew above the carton was all gone when we came home.
It is very discouraging, and animals, I think, really try the patience of every gardener. One of the keys with a fence is it needs to be at least 4 feet high and tight to the ground if you're trying to keep rabbits out. For deer, at least 5 feet tall and around small areas. I think sometimes we underestimate those rabbits' ability to get over our fencing. And then the gate needs to be secure, too, because if there's a gap there.
My mother has taught me to garden, and she found a rabbit in her garden when her fence was only 4 feet high, so I kind of am aware of that.
Okay, and I just want to make sure other people, other people that may not be aware. Scare tactics work if you're in a quiet area. I live in the city. There's no amount of noise or human smell I could provide that's going to scare the rabbits in my yard. Their patterns change as populations grow. Sometimes if a new subdivision's been built or construction's happened, their populations go in cycles, and so some years we'll have peak rabbit population. And, boy, I think I saw a lot more rabbits this winter than I had in the past. And then their habitat changes, too. They'll move a little bit. And I'm really getting into Scott Craven's area, so make sure you guys talk about that when he's on. You mentioned repellents. Whenever possible, if you can spray before they start eating, that's always helpful. There is an all-natural product out on the market called Bob-X-R. Bob-X for deer was more effective than any of the other repellents in some research done in Connecticut. Bob-X-R, a little more cayenne pepper, has longer sticking ability, so it sets up quick. It sets up, and then once it sets up, it's going to last longer. It's by smell and taste, so you don't want to spray the leaf lettuce you're going to eat, but the area around it or the leaves of your tomatoes, because it won't hurt you. It just will kind of taint that flavor. That should may help you with the squirrels, rabbits, and the chipmunks. There are some animal repellents. There's a sprinkler system that works for deer that uses motion sensitive, and the sprinkler goes off. Well, there's a shorter version called Mini Scarecrow that uses compressed air and sound. And so the animals, you can set it low to the ground. So the animals walk by, you get a blast of air, and then this terrible loud noise. Now, you and your neighbors have to agree to this, or they're going to be calling me. But then the idea is once they get used to the idea that I feel the air and I'm going to hear this loud noise, the idea is then you turn off the sound, and then they get the blast of compressed air, they leave. It's just trying a variety of strategies and techniques where if you're fencing, like you said, you got to keep an eye on them, use some repellents. Just trying a variety of strategies. You may want to try several different repellents as well if you're finding one doesn't work. I wish I had the answer. I think I'd be a millionaire. But those are some strategies you might want to try. I had one hosta grower that said she had a lawn full of clover, and she felt that helped keep the rabbits eating the clover instead of her hostas. Some people think it's just the appetizer for the main course. So I wish I had a good answer for you, but I if you haven't tried Bob XR, I'd give that a try as well. Try changing up your repellent. And as you know, if you've been gardening a long time, you know it's a matter of persistence. And they have all day to think about how to get at your plants, or you have other things to do.
There you go. Thanks a lot for calling. Our guest today, Melinda Myers, Milwaukee-based garden guru. I'm Larry Mueller. Judith Sears-Poisson, our producer, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll take more of your gardening questions at 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Lots of people have gone to the Facebook page, and Michael even sent some nice shots of a fox in the area. Pretty cool pictures. But we also have Mike from another Mike who says, something's eating all my beet tops. He has a 6-foot fence surrounded by an electric fence with 7,000 volts. Carrots, rutabaga, radish, all okay. Zone 3 in Price County.
You know, birds can sometimes cause an issue on your crops, as well as, you know, those things that can crawl over and under. Look for any signs of woodchucks burrowing. They go down 12 to 18 inches deep. Those are even worse than rabbits in my book to control. So I'd kind of keep an eye on that. I just want to comment on the other Michael's photo of the fox. They
yeah.
are great predators for all the animals we talked about. You
yes.
know, I love little rabbits, and I can tell you how to get rid of them, but it's really hard for me to do it. But if a fox or an owl or a hawk take them out when they're big, I don't have to look, and I'm not responsible. So the cool thing about fox, and I've seen a lot in the Milwaukee area, is they are out doing some hunting, helping us with some of those problem animals. The other thing he might want to do, and others growing greens, is just at least cover it with some kind of netting initially. So if it is birds coming from above or even rabbits, it sounds like he's got every barrier possible. I'd love to see a video of him going into his garden through the electric fence and that 6-foot fence. But if something is squeezing under a gate or something, you know, adding that little season extending fabric, that floating row cover, bridal veil netting, something like that, that fine mesh, might just give that added protection. And it might also help him find out what's eating on it, too.
Yeah, good point. We had an email from Susan. We have either Septoria leaf spot or early blight. On the UW Extension pamphlets, it says as a last resort, turn to fungicides. How do we decide when is the last resort?
I think what we're all trying to do is encourage a change of habit for gardeners who maybe the first thing that used to happen 20 years ago is you'd reach for the spray and,
yeah.
and spray. If it's septoria leaf spot, it's pretty easy to tell because those brown spots are almost like perfect circles.
Yeah.
And the good or bad thing about the disease is it doesn't kill your plant, and you'll still get tomatoes, maybe a little less. They'll be ugly by the end of the season, but you'll still have a lot of tomatoes. Early blight can affect the fruit as well, but it can be controlled, where late blight is what we worry about because that takes things out really, you know, quickly. So if you've got those perfect circular spots, and this is more where your choice is going to come. Well, you know, I'm seeing a lot of damage. I don't want to, I have 3 tomatoes, so I can't afford to reduce the production. Or I have 80 tomatoes, and boy, if I have a few less on each plant, it's okay. You might not want to spray. Copper-containing fungicides are classed as organic. There are synthetic forms as well. Just check the label. Both will work on early blight and the septoria leaf spot. So if you're just seeing signs, if it sounds like we're going to continue to get some rainy weather later in the season, that's when the disease is going to spread more rapidly. You might want to go, okay, it's a little dry now. I'll kind of wait and see what happens. Pick off the infected leaves. If we're going for a rainy period, you might want to spray at that point, and especially if you're seeing a lot of damage or have limited plants and really are counting on a big harvest.
Kevin in Arlington has a question for you, Melinda. Let's go there. Hi, Kevin.
Hi, thank you. I don't know if a horticulturist from the city of Milwaukee can handle this one or not.
Okay, we'll see.
But I have a farm, and I've planted a number of white spruce, Norway spruce, and white pines in the fence, some of the fence lines. And I have a problem with wild grapevine growing
uh-huh.
up them. And I have been pulling them down over the years, and I guess pulling the roots out to some extent. They're kind of hard to find in the tall grass and all that. And I'm just, I've been trying to do it without chemicals, but I'm wondering if you've got a better suggestion for me.
What I like to do when I've got vines climbing up into trees, or not me, but when I'm advising someone with vines climbing up in the trees, is one is just to start by cutting them right at ground level. Then they're going to dry up and die, and they'll stop harming your tree. And so if you continually, and this is a lot of work, if you don't want to use chemicals, continually cutting, but then look for all those suckers that are forming all over and feeding the root system, but continually cutting them to ground level is an option. I think the good news is we're starting to see some newer products on the market. I haven't seen anything that's classed organic that would take that out. I just tried a new broadleaf weed killer just, I wanted to throw this in. It's just something that I just tried for the first time using chelated iron as the active ingredient. And it's selective. It doesn't kill grass, but it kills broadleaf weeds, and have used it and have seen some good results. I don't think it's going to work on your grapevine because it's so big and hardy, and I don't think it's labeled for that. If you want to use a chemical, cutting it back to ground level, letting it resprout, and then applying it just to the leaves of the grapevine, and you'll need to do repeat applications, can minimize your use of that chemical and still not only kill the leaves, but then start being moved down into the root system, so you'll knock out the roots as well as the top. You know, I'm a big believer that if you are going to use chemicals, try to be very selective and apply just as needed. So
yep.
Continually pruning the top, you'll eventually starve it out if you can outlast the grapes. And then your second option is, spot treating with a chemical.
There you go. Thanks very much for calling. Speaking of grapes, my neighbor, we have a fence between our two properties, and my neighbor's grapes have come over the top of the fence over to my side.
Ooh.
And there are tons of grapes.
Oh, the good kind of grapes.
The good kind of grapes.
Oh, I was like, oh, darn. I guess you'll just have to help him harvest when they get ripe. Huh?
I am eagerly awaiting the harvest of my neighbor's grapes.
I can see out there with your plate of cheese, a glass of wine, and just wait for those grapes to fill up.
Oh, man. Mike in Mineral Point has a question or comment. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry and Melinda. Great show. Just a quick thought. I've got a friend of mine who, to repel rabbits, suggested the idea, and it worked for very well, to lay a green garden hose around the garden. And rabbits, because of the predatory response, sometimes view that as a snake, and it has a psychological deterrent. It lasts indeterminately, but she swears by that method. That isn't my question. My question is I've seen a new pest deterrent, which is a ultrasonic device along with a light as well, and I've seen them in some gardening catalogs. And I was concerned curious about how effective ultrasonics are to deter pests. It's something that I've considered purchasing, but I thought I'd bounce that off of the guest, Melinda.
Well, and I'm gonna hopefully correctly quote Scott. When I used to work for Extension and was doing Master Gardener training, I remember him talking about a bat deterrent that was supposed to use ultrasonic sound, and he went in the belfry of the church, and it was just loaded with bats, and they'd been using this thing. You may want to check in with him as well. Everything I can remember him talking about and research I've read has not proved that they were effective.
Yeah.
So you may want to just confirm that. I do want to address your snake thing. I have a funny story. If you do the rubber snakes or the hose, move them around so that the rabbits don't get used to them. My dad, I grew up with a cherry tree in my backyard, and my dad was determined to beat the birds. And the neighbor's cat would walk around the yard, and the birds would dive bomb the cat. Our cat was in the house. He tried sound tactics. He tried draping bird netting over, and somehow they got in. So he hung these rubber snakes in the tree, and the birds ate everything but about a dozen cherries right around the snakes. And then they put the cherry pits on top of his tomato steaks, kind of like to rub it in. And I think it's definitely worth a try. I think you have to be very creative, but that story, when I hear about the rubber snakes, I can always remember my dad and his battle with the birds. The cherry tree died, and I think it was a great stress release for him.
Oh, boy. Thanks, Mike, for calling. John in Dodgeville, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, how are you guys today?
Good.
Great.
All right, I got a question for you. I'm just starting to get some pea pods and cucumbers, and they're not a finished fruit. Like some of the cucumbers have a little swing in the bottoms, and the the pea pods are not nice and long and slender. And I just have the feeling, what I did was I just had the feeling that it was a pH problem. So I just bought a cheap probe and stuck it in the ground. And I've been reading where peas and cucumbers need a lower pH, and my pH is over 7. And I'm wondering if there's any last-minute thing you can do, something soluble that will immediately alter the pH?
What kind of, well, what, a couple of things. Is I garden in soils with a pH of about 7.3 here in Milwaukee. And,
yeah, that's about and, what it is.
Yeah, and that's pretty typical. And also the community gardens I used to manage and that are still there, about the same kind of pH. And peas and cucumbers were fine. It can be a nutrient issue or and often related to weather even more than pH. Most plants do like, you know, a 6.5 to 7 would be perfect.
Okay.
But you heard Larry's groan because he knows the answers. It's very hard to change the soil pH.
Yeah, you got to do it in the fall, right?
And then our soils are so highly buffered that anything you do, the soil keeps pushing out to change that chemistry back.
Okay.
Using organic mulches helps to fix the soil. Organic material helps to monitor or moderate the alkalinity. It doesn't lower it greatly, but it can help maintain it.
Okay.
Using rainwater instead of tap water, our water we pull from the ground or our taps tend to be in the pH. When I had someone tested here in Milwaukee, was around 8.
Oh.
It's like liming your soil.
Yeah, I noticed my well water is about 7.3.
Okay, because it's pulling it from the ground.
Yeah.
So anytime you can use water, you know, capture water in a rain barrel and use it, that helps. One of the things you might want to try, what kind of fertilization did you do, or any?
Oh, I just, well, for instance, I grew the cucumbers. I started them early, and then when I planted them, I mixed some Miracle-Gro garden soil, about half and half, and mix that in before while I was planting, you know?
Yeah, you may want to. We've had such crazy weather, and I feel like every year I blame the weather, but every year it's crazy. But you may want to do a slow-release, low-nitrogen fertilizer. And why I'm recommending slow-release, you're thinking, I want quick results. You don't want to push a lot of growth into leaves. The higher nitrogen fertilizers give you a quick hit, but then they disappear.
Sure.
With the hot weather, and if you miss watering, those high nitrogen soluble things can also damage your plant. So using a low nitrogen slow release can help. I think you all know I'm a fan of Allurganite, but one of the reasons I like it, besides being low nitrogen slow release, is research has shown that the phosphorus, it has a little bit of phosphorus, which is good for flowering and fruiting. But research showed when microorganisms worked on the Allurganite to release the nutrients, it released phosphorus and potassium we have in our soil, which tends to be high to excessive but not available to plants. And you can't burn your garden. So if you do a little side dressing,
yeah,
you may, you know, can't fix what's not fully developed now, but it may help you, especially with those cucumbers that are going to keep producing, and hopefully we'll get enough moderate weather, your peas will keep producing. But doing that around your vegetables will help give it a boost. I found I do a lot of organics in my soils, compost, and I think the rain, the cool, I'm doing a little more fertilization than I usually do. And I think that weather, so I'll maybe give that a try.
Thanks, John, for calling. Appreciate your call. On our Facebook page, Linda says, two or three branches of my lilac bush have almost no leaves. The few leaves that are there are much smaller than the leaves on the rest of the bush. All the leaves are green. There were blooms on them this spring. What could be causing this, and what can I do about it? I thought about cutting them out, but it would leave a big hole if I did.
Yeah, a couple things I want you to do, Linda, is one is to take a look at the base of the stems. A couple things come to mind. There's borers that will bore into typically the older stems on lilacs, and then that feeding can interfere with the flow of water and nutrients and cause, you know, you may have had enough energy last summer for the flower buds to form, but we went through winter, and by the time they needed to pull nutrients up for leaf development, they didn't, or there was limited, and that's why they're smaller. Scale insects also can cause that problem. They're small insects that you could scrape off. They're usually white ones on the lilacs at the base, and you can scrape those off with your thumbnail. And those insects suck plant juices, and they can cause a weakening of the stem and eventually even some dieback. Now, regular pruning often takes care of both of those. And so that's kind of a nice thing that you don't have to break out the sprays and try to control them. The third thing that could be a problem is bacterial blight, which the leaves typically look curled, almost like they've been hit with an herbicide. Pruning and disinfecting your stems between, or your pruners between cuts, will help reduce the risk of spreading. So I would take a look, and if those are the problems, pruning is really your best solution, and then proper care. And though you'll have a hole now, the good news is you're opening it up better light, and hopefully some of those younger, thinner suckers will start growing and filling in. Regular pruning, taking a few older stems right back to ground level every couple of years, really will help new growth flourish, keep your lilacs down to size, reduce pest problems, and you'll have a better-looking plant with leaves from top to bottom.
Absolutely. Esther in Mequon, we turn to you now. Hi, Esther.
Oh, thank you. My question is about onion sets, S-E-T-S.
Mm-hmm.
How are they produced? How do they make onion sets, put it that way?
Onions are bulbs, and, well, there's two kinds. There are top-multiplying onions. If you've ever heard of walking onions or Egyptian onions,
yes.
Those form their sets on top. Then the top, the stem with the sets falls down. They plant themselves, and then they can really take over a garden if they're left unattended, and that kind of how you replenish. Then bottom multipliers are kind of like tulips and things like that, where they send offsets off the side of the bulb. And so in areas where they're producing them, smaller offsets are formed, and those are sets also. And I'm assuming, I haven't even thought about where, I'm guessing maybe onions in the Northwest, maybe. I'm not sure where they do production of onions.
I'm not sure either.
That's a good question. That's
yeah,
a
thank you. I thought so, too. I've been pondering it for a long
time. This is the best part of, this is why I love being on Larry's show. I get to talk to gardeners, and I always have homework to do. So I learn something new.
Thanks, Esther. Thank you for calling. And Dan in Madison, we are on to you now. Hi, Dan.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call today. We only planted two zucchini plants this year because last year they were so prolific. Now, they flowered, but the blossoms didn't get very big, and they're falling off. Is that something to worry about?
No, and I'm glad you asked this question because you're going to take care of a lot of people's stress in the next few weeks. The first set of flowers on cucumbers and squash and other vine crops are typically all male. And if you look at the flower, they just have the male plant parts, which look like little pins stuck in the middle in a straight stem. The second flush of flowers are male and female. The female has a small immature zucchini or squash or cucumber at the base of the flower. Then you've got male and female. You get pollination, fertilization, and then you'll start to get fruit developing. So my guess is if the plants look healthy and they're just started blooming, that it may be that you have all male flowers and that they'll keep blooming, and as it goes, you'll get both. If you have both male and female flowers, check and make sure you have some bee activity. Otherwise, some gardeners will go in with a Q-tip or a little paintbrush and just take the pollen from the male and wipe it onto the female flower parts to help encourage pollination and fertilization.
Okay, now we do have a flower bed out there, and there are a couple of small zucchinis on each of the plants.
Okay, and it may be that now you're starting to get both. The other key thing is, and I'm also glad you mentioned that, is picking your zucchini when they're 6 to 8 inches long, if they're the bar type, and 3 or 4 inches, no more than 3 or 4 inches in diameter for the scallopini, because regular harvesting keeps the plant producing. The baseball bat size zucchinis are a conversation piece, but you know, it's hard to get rid of those. They're not as tasty. And that kind of, the plant then has done its job. It's produced. It's got seeds to reproduce. It's done. And you don't get all the production that you want. So I would just kind of keep an eye on it. It sounds like you're just, you know, starting to get those flowers coming and more females should be forming.
And thanks a lot for calling, Dan. Appreciate your call. And Vivian in Reedsburg, we are on to you. Hi, Vivian.
Oh, hi, good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have an invasive plant that I want to get rid of. I believe the name of it is a yellow archangel. It's in the mint family.
Yeah.
And it's, you know, I live in the sand counties. Nothing grows here, but this stuff has taken off into the woods. Is there something that you can recommend that is organic? Or I hate to just put strong herbicide on it.
Yeah, there's a couple things you might want to try. It used to be, the botanical name used to be Lamiastrum. Now it's Lamium. And the reason I mention that, it's a close relative of dead nettle. Both are tarn of dry shade, which is exactly what you have in your woods up there. Pulling and pulling and pulling is probably the most eco-friendly option, or cutting it back until you starve it to death. This new product, I have not tried it on. I just have used it a little bit. Again, it's new for me this year. I think it just was actually introduced, which uses iron, chelated iron as the active ingredient. I think Bayer was supposed to have it out. I didn't find it in their product. Whitney Farms, I found it. A little hard to find. Yeah, I think that was the company. I think that's the brand I was able to put my hands on. Tried it earlier. It didn't seem to work well when the weather was cool. Tried it again recently, and it really, it knocks out the broadleaf weeds, and then it greens up. If it gets on your grass, it greens that up. So if you have other broadleaf plants, though, it could damage those. Total vegetation killers using plant oils and soaps and things like that burn the top off. And so it's not going to kill the roots, but repeated applications are an option. And whether you use a synthetic or an organic, you know, just minimizing the impact on the surrounding plants is a good idea. One gardener and his neighbor came up with what they call the tongs of death, and they take long tongs, only used for the garden, put sponges on the end, and then dip it in a total vegetation killer at the proper concentration, and then wipe it on the leaves to try to minimize the impact and the quantity of product used. Or you could just use a sponge paintbrush and paint the top of the leaves as well, being sure you wear gloves to keep it off your skin.
The area we're looking at is easily 1,000 square feet, I bet, by this point. So huge. I'm wondering, we even thought about using a sod cutter.
And just cutting it up?
Yeah.
Are there a lot of spring ephemerals in the area? The other concern is you're maybe removing a lot of seeds and a lot of your native plants in that area.
Yeah, the area that it's most concerned is under a whole grove of pine trees, so there isn't much growing underneath it, period.
I mean,
typically, this is becoming a green ground cover, which is not desirable, really.
Okay. You know, the other thing you might want to do, rather than cut it up, if you don't want to use chemicals yet, then a sod cutter might work. The problem is any little piece that is left will start, but at least you'll gain some ground on it.
Yes.
And then, you know, find a good place to dispose of it. So if you compost it, you'll just be reintroducing it back in the garden, because that stuff will survive.
Okay.
Unless you really compost really hot, and most of us just can't do that. So.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
And if it works for you, let us know.
Yes, please do.
Sounds good. Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye. Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Talking gardening today with my guest, Melinda Myers, Milwaukee-based garden guru. Join in with your questions by going to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Lots of questions and some other photos. You're going to have to update there, Melinda, to see the next pictures that are up, or photos, if you haven't done that lately. And join us by phone at 1-800-642-1234. Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Talking gardening today with Melinda Myers. Larry Mueller here. Thank you so much for listening in. Go to our Facebook page and take a look at the Larry Mueller Show. There are lots of photos there, including one that Pam sent that via email, but then Judith posted on our Facebook page so that we could see it. Some of our tomatoes have been gnarling, have had this gnarling of their leaves, and we're wondering if you'd know, Mel, what would be the cause. We have a 3-year rotation of our tomatoes and try to have a new garden every year. 56 plants were started from seed and planted in our two gardens this year. Picked my first tomato this spring. It was from a stupid plant. Is that what it is?
Oh, here we go. Okay, good. I just got it. Ooh, okay, a couple things to look for. That kind of growth, and if you have access to the computer at some point, you want to look at it. When I see that kind of curled growth, the first thing that comes to mind is herbicide damage.
Yes, me too.
If someone is using a broadleaf weed killer in the area and it can drift in, one year I talked to someone and found out they used it in the pathways of their garden, thinking it just killed weeds. So you want to keep those broadleaf weed killers out of the garden and away from the plants. But, you know, we've had so many windy days. I mean, it's unbelievable that somebody in the area might have sprayed and it came on and that caused that real distorted growth. Some viruses will do that, but you would be able to tell by a pattern, usually discoloration in the leaves. Aphids, not quite. When I look at the distortion, though, that looks so typical herbicide damage. Aphids and spider mites will cause some curling, but not that fasciation where the veins are kind of parallel and distorted. If the plants continue to grow and produce fruit, my understanding from specialists I've talked to and others is that it's safe to grow, it's safe to eat, because if your plants have outgrown that, you don't want to ever use it on your plants purposely. So I would kind of watch, look around. If you use the weed killer, you learned a valuable lesson. So cut yourself a break and just say, okay, next year we won't do it on a windy day. We'll put some kind of protection out there first. And if you have a lawn care company, you know, have them notify you before they come and spray. The same with your neighbors if they have a lawn care company, so you can either put some kind of protection or be around if possible to make sure that they're doing it safely. Most are good out there, but occasionally, you know, they're in a hurry and the winds are high and they got 500 yards to do and sometimes aren't as careful as we'd like them to be.
We had an email from Bob in Jackson, Wisconsin. Any clues for serviceberry leaves turning yellow and getting brittle and falling off? Do note very small dark spots. I'm okay with sprays if needed.
A couple things. There is a lace bug that, not a lace wing, the good one, but a lace bug that will feed on serviceberries. I see it a lot in hot, dry years, occasionally, not every year. They typically eat the upper surface of the leaves, cause some browning, almost a lacy appearance. The black dots sometimes are their droppings that you may see.
Yeah.
That's one thing that could cause the damage. I'd make sure they're present before spraying and then do something real eco-friendly. I don't know where your service berries are, but mine are ready to be made into a pie and to be eaten as I weed today. And so I, you know, I'll put up with the leaf damage, but you know, yours may be a little further past, or you may be not eating them. I'd wait till the birds clean them up before spraying. The other thing is they will get scab occasionally because they're in the same family as crabapples and mountain ash. Usually not bad, and so it usually doesn't warrant control. And once you see the spots, if they're large spots like scab on crabapples, you know, just kind of keep an eye on a good cleanup this fall. If we have another rainy year like we've had the last two springs, you might want to use a preventative fungicide, but usually not enough of a problem on serviceberry to warrant. Fire blight causes the leaves to turn black, you know, the stems to curl, and that's pretty serious, but not common, not very common. If you see that, prune off the infected branch beneath the canker, sunken, discolored part, into healthy wood, and then disinfect your tools between cuts, and then so you don't want to spread it. But I'm guessing, look for the lace bugs, kind of monitor, watch the watering. You know, they do like moist soils, not wet and soggy. We've had good rains up to this point in most parts of the state. Mulching keeps the roots cool and moist, which is good. And, you know, the cool, the hot, the cool, the hot. I'm just seeing some of my plants that are in somewhat shade really getting a little bit of scorch more than normal, you know, in the afternoon sun, just because when the heat's up and then it's cool, I just don't think they're making that adjustment as quickly as they need to.
We have an email from Alan. My aunt gave me seeds from her hollyhock several years ago. They came up every year and have even spread, but every year early in the season they get a rust on the leaves and holes in the leaves. The new ones take longer to develop the problem, but they do get it. Don't get any more flowers.
Usually if you keep them thinned out and get good airflow and good light penetration, you'll still get rust, but it's usually at a level that you'll still get the flowers. I'm kind of lazy, so when I grow hollyhocks, and I've had them for about 10 years, and I have a little yard, so I've kind of let them die out for a while, and I'll bring some new ones in a few. But I put some medium-sized plants in front, covered the foliage so the flowers peaked above, the plants survived, reseeded, and I didn't have to do any spraying. Lazy solution to the problem. The other thing you can do is there's a sawfly and a caterpillar that cause the laziness, and, you know, you can use an insecticide. You might want to use something like neem. For the rust, a fungicide, you may check the label of neem. There's a formulation that will take care of diseases as well as insects and mites. You might check the label. Otherwise, going to a commercial fungicide, rust is difficult to control. The other thing I wanted to mention is there's a new category of products on the market for gardeners called plant strengtheners. And these are like immunizations. They don't kill insects. They don't kill diseases. But scientists found that when plants were under stress by insects, disease, or weather conditions, they produced more enzymes, in this case, jasminoid. And they were able to isolate it, apply it to the plants, and then that was like giving an immunization. The plants were stronger, better able to tolerate insects, disease, and stress. Not killing them, but better able to tolerate. So you'd have better looking plants without using the pesticides, or a lot fewer. And jazz, like the music JAS for jasminoides, which is the enzyme they found, jazz spray is one of those. Just released in Wisconsin for the plant strengthener. The rose spray's been out. But it's I like it because it's natural and it's a new tool for us to use. You know, you can strengthen your plants and do something more organic but still have some good results. So if you don't want to use the chemicals for the rust and the insects, you might want to give the jazz spray a try just to see if you can build up the strength or put something in front of it and hide the problem.
Well, Rick in South Range has a question. Let's go to Rick. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. Thanks for taking the call. I have a question about a really nasty infestation of horsetail. I've asked you about it in the past, but my wife and I have gone into it and very carefully tried to get all the roots out in the strawberries, and we've been fairly successful at that. But now we're wondering about the asparagus, which are these asparagus roots salvageable, or should we just kill everything and build a new asparagus patch somewhere else?
I probably wouldn't kill everything, but I might start a new asparagus patch. You know, I don't know if you like asparagus. In my book, you can't have enough in the spring. And
three more.
You know, I would probably start another one. Keep at it with the bottle brush. You know, it is one of those. I haven't found that Roundup's very effective on it. Pulling and digging seem to be your best bet. I'm concerned that, and then what that would do is if you can keep at least the weed population down, get your new asparagus patch started. If you don't get it under control like you did in the strawberries, then you could till up, destroy, you know, start over with something else in that area where it'd be easier to manage, or just, you know, grow something you can mow. And then your asparagus would be ready for picking, too. So, you'll either end up with twice as much as you need, or at least by the time you give up on this patch, you'll have asparagus coming into your new one.
Okay. So these particular plants, these asparagus plants, they're not the healthiest I've ever had anyhow.
Yeah.
Well, you know what? And there's some new varieties out. I don't know how long. You know, the Jersey Giants and Jersey Knight out of New Jersey, Rutgers University, produce some nice size, good, tender, but plump stems of asparagus and have good disease resistance. So this maybe is the motivation and a hard way to start that new plot.
Yeah.
I appreciate the advice. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling.
Appreciate it. Ellen in Bailey's Harbor, on to you. Hi, Ellen.
Well, hi. You know, I just got a new septic system, and I got a monster field of dirt right now, and I thought I'd plant wildflowers on my mound.
Mm-hmm.
Sure.
And I got the stuff in the mail today, and it's about, I would say, 30% annual and 70% perennial with a few biennials in it. If I plant this stuff now, which I have to do because the county wants me to, am I going to lose all the annuals next spring?
Well, yeah, they'll grow out and be knocked out. What you may want to do is do just a green manure crop and do like an annual rye or a buckwheat or something to cover the ground. That'll help cover the ground. You can always till that in. And then in the spring, plant your seed. Just keep your seed in a cool spot, or if the seed, depending on what those annuals are, sometimes a late fall planting, they'll sit in the ground and then sprout. But I'm worried, like you said, if you do it now, those annuals are going to pop. You'll get some enjoyment this year, but when the frost comes, they're done. So you'd either need to wait till, and you know, I'd follow the directions from your seed provider. But you can store that stuff too in a refrigerator. I keep seeds in my spare refrigerator. You may want to touch base with them to make sure if you have problems, you followed their directions. But right. you could do a green manure crop, and that'll take care of your county concern and give you some more time.
Okay, another question. I also ordered some Nomo grass seed, which is a combination of citrus and fescue.
Right.
And you want to put
that...
If
you can, you know what I would do? I would wait, if you can, wait to plant that in late August. You can plant seed now. The problem is it's so hot that it doesn't. The top doesn't grow as well. You need to water. I mean, I've planted grass seed, I think, every month of the summer because I was in a situation somewhere where I had to. And you just don't have as good success, and you have to work a lot harder. If you can wait and plant in late August, again, you're going to have, that's plenty of time to get that in, get it started. It's the best time, really, to see grass, actually.
Absolutely. Melinda Myers, Milwaukee-based gardening expert, garden guru, and author of more than 20 books. Our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We're taking a look at your garden here on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Melinda Myers, Milwaukee-based gardening guru. Melinda, I meant to mention your website and I completely forgot. So tell us about that website.
It's melindamyers.com, and we've got video, audio tips, frequently asked questions. If you post a question to me, please be patient. You're outnumbering me. I'm doing my best. but we're always trying to get resources. We have photos. I'm on Facebook as well and Twitter, so I try to do some educational tweets, and I'm on the road. If I see a cool plant or we're doing something fun or we're in a garden that I think you'd enjoy, sending that out. So try to be helpful as possible, and if you've got ideas or suggestions on things we should include, I'd love to hear from you. But I think it's the years of working with folks like you, Larry, and gardeners that it's been fun to share what I learn along the way, and hopefully we can all help each other grow better gardens.
No, you've got a great site there, that's
Thank
for
you.
Sure. Grace in Green Bay has a question for you. Let's go to Grace. Hi.
Hi, Grace. Hi. I am Grace. I have a question. Is what is mulch, like what I can use for mulch, like old hay bales or when I cut my irises down? And another thing is I have no computer and a lot of people don't. We need to know someplace else to go.
I hear you. One of the good things, and I feel your pain, a lot of the libraries do offer free use of computers. I know that may not be the only solution. I'm not sure. Garden centers, if you can get there in person, are good places to go. Nature centers. Some extension offices, though their budgets are being cut, and a lot of them are depending a lot on electronic media to get the information out as well. That's the other reason I like coming on with Larry, because we, one, get to talk to each other, which is the best, and two, it's another option for those of you that are struggling. My books and then my Melinda's Garden Moment TV are also on DVD, so those are available at garden centers and bookstores too. So we'll keep working on that. I haven't done a written newsletter just because of budget and time constraints, but we'll keep pondering that. So if you have any other ideas, I'd love to hear them. About mulch, we'll go to something I can fix, hopefully. mulch, and just for that term's used in a lot of different ways. So for people that may be new at gardening, when I talk about mulching, I talk about putting a layer something over the soil surface to conserve moisture, suppress weeds. I like organic mulches because when they break down, they improve the soil, they moderate soil temperature, they do lots of good things. Disease-free, non-invasive, non-aggressive plant materials. If I pull my annual weeds before they've gone to seed, I'll let them just kind of sit out and dry on the patio, and then I'll tuck them under my trees and shrubs and use them as mulch. Things like creeping Charlie, quack grass, those things, invasive weeds, talk to your municipality. Those things, most of us don't compost hot enough to kill them, and they will just root in our compost, and you'll reintroduce them. A friend of mine always said the best control for quack grass was to pull it, burn it, and spread the ashes on the concrete. He was joking, but part of a lot of your pregnant, maybe not a bad idea. Most municipalities will let you bag invasive weeds, write that on a clear bag. A lot of people will solarize them that way. Other things. I live in the city, but I don't know where all my leaves come from, the park, my neighbors, but I always have plenty of leaves. I shred them with my electric mower, And then I use those as mulch on the soil. And I seem to always have an endless supply. Saves me from hauling away, lets me recycle them in place. If you have a lot of evergreen, evergreen needles make a great mulch in the soil, too. The problem with straw and hay is they tend to have a lot of weed seed. So when you hear people talk about marsh hay, it's collecting hay from areas that are wet. So when you're putting it in a more dry garden, that those hopefully weeds won't sprout. And straw is supposed to be weed-free. You may want to find a good source before you start using it. But those are some examples. Stone is decorative, doesn't fix the soil. Plastic's not a fan. It ruins your soil. Weed barriers only under stone, under wood chips and shredded bark and things, which work great around trees. Don't put that on weed barrier. As it breaks down, it blocks the flow of water and nutrients in the weed barrier. Roots, you know, weeds can root in. It becomes a mess, and 5 years down the road, you'll just have a disaster. Wood chips, shredded bark, great on trees and shrubs. Pathways, twice shredded on perennials. I limit it around annuals. So hopefully that helps.
Thanks, Grace. Thank you very much for calling. I want to give Sarah in Madison a chance. Sarah, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thank you for taking yet another tomato question.
Sure.
It's that time of year, isn't it?
I was wondering how I can encourage my plants to produce more flowers.
You know, with the cool start this season, you know, we've had some good warm days interspersed. You know, I think the warm weather is here. It feels like it anyway. That's really going to help speed things up. At this point, that's about, you know, it's waiting for the weather. A couple of things that I have found useful in the beginning of the season, so this is that note for next year, even when I plant my tomatoes Memorial Day, I'll often cover them with weed floating row covers, season-extending fabrics, because the nights can be pretty cool in June. That really jump-starts them. Even if I don't plant earlier, it pushes them. Those red tomato booster things, I thought were a scam. Didn't believe they worked. And I do work with Birds in Bloom, and Roy Ryman had introduced the very first ones, and he said, oh, these are great. And so I said, okay, I'll humor him. I'll try them in my garden. And you know what? It made a huge difference. Research has shown red reflects and increases productivity. And I'll tell you, I was skeptical, but they're just little trays that capture the moisture, concentrate a little bit of mulch around the plants, and really sped things up. At this point in time, it's just, you know, hoping for some nice warm weather, good sunlight, and I think we're going to have a good, I'm thinking positively like every gardener, we're going to have a good harvest this year.
There you go. Thank you, Sarah, for calling. And Jean and Spooner, it's your turn. Hi, Jean.
Hi. I have a rhubarb question.
Okay.
I have 6 rhubarb plants that have been in the same place for about 15 years. They've gotten more and more spindly, to the point where they're smaller than my little finger and you can't even, they're not even worth cutting. They're covered with oak leaves in the winter, and I'm wondering if that does something to the pH of the soil. Or lots of trees around them if they're not getting enough sun?
Yeah, the good questions. The oak leaves are not affecting the soil pH. I'm not a fan of leaf mulch, but if you've had good luck, you'll want to keep using it. I just find they can mat down, ice up, and aren't the best insulators, but that's not your problem. I think you guessed right, though. All those trees around it probably have gotten bigger, the canopy's denser, less sunlight. If you have a sunnier area, I would recommend moving them to the sunnier spot. I was going to suggest if they're overgrown, you might want to just lift them, amend the soil using an activated compost, you know, something like a purple cow to amend the soil before you replant. That's a good idea even if you move them. But if you think it's just the soil and overcrowding, fix the soil before you replant. But it sounds like light is the issue. And so you might want to get another area started in a fuller sun location and see if you have good luck. The other thing you can do is you can grow rhubarb in a pot and then sink it in a vacant area. You need to insulate those roots for winter. So you might want to put it in an old shrub or tree container, grow it in a container, then in the fall bury that pot in a vacant part of the ground, lift it up and put it in a sunny spot if you don't have a good sunny spot that you can plant in the ground.
There you go.
And transplanting should be in the fall?
You could do the fall. I'm a spring transplant person. A lot of the literature you read says fall. I just feel like in spring you've got that chance to, right as it sprouts, to get it up, get it reestablished, and you've got a whole growing season ahead of you. Either one usually works. I just usually do it in the spring.
There you go. Thank you, Jean. Terry in Madison, on to you. Hi, Terry.
Hi, Larry. Can you hear me all right?
Yes.
How can we help?
Good. I have a plant growing in my front yard. I at first thought it was Queen Anne's lace, which I like, and I think it's hemlock, and I like it just fine, but I want to know how poisonous is it really?
Usually the water hemlock is more of a water plant. There are other plants like the poisonous parsnip that can be pretty bad. Angelica is a little more like a lady's, or like a Queen Anne's lace on steroids, much bigger leaf and bolder leaves. In most of it, if I'm remembering correctly, it's a dermatitis response. So when you touch it and you're in the sunlight, you break out in a rash.
Okay.
So if you have access to the internet, I would look up, water hemlock and poisonous hemlock and do a comparison. I find doing an image search is a great way. Look for university sites or nature center sites to compare a wildflower,
I'm familiar. I will do that. I have touched it and nothing has happened.
Yeah, and we all are very, and it all varies in how we respond. I never get poison ivy. I have to tell you, I got this product for free. They're not a client of mine or anything, but it's called Zanafel, Zanafel.
Uh-huh.
It's an all-natural product. If you do get a rash on you, I don't get poison ivy, knock on wood so far, but a friend of mine was working in his yard, and I said, oh, try this. I've been wanting to find someone to try this. He had started developing, and by the next day it was gone. So for those that are very allergic, you might want to give it a try again. It's just something new. I haven't gotten it. It's supposed to work on those kind of reactions. So, So check out and make sure, and from that standpoint, you should be okay.
All right, thanks.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Gail in Fish Creek, on to you now. Hi, Gail.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, hey, I've been trying to call the last few times that you've been on, and I'm finally glad I'm getting through.
Me too.
A friend of mine has Jerusalem artichokes.
Oh.
And we're wanting to transfer some from her yard into ours, and we're wondering when's a good time to do that and what we need to do, because we're not sure. Hers are like natural. They've been there for a long time. And do you have any information? Because they're like so unusual.
Yeah, when I was with the community garden program quite a few years ago, we had somebody plant Jerusalem artichokes down in one of the gardens on the county institution ground.
Ooh.
And it took over about, Larry obviously has experience with
uh-huh.
these. Took over like 40, 30 by 30 plots. So they're interesting. They're supposed to be they kind of have the taste of a water chestnut, sunflower, kind of like a daisy-like sunflower-like flower head, big, tall plants. They spread rapidly. I would only grow them if I could keep them contained somehow. I just want to warn you so that in 10 years you don't hate me, okay?
Oh, no problem.
Okay. You can dig them up. They're so, you could probably dig a chunk right now and transplant them. Spring would be a good time since they're really getting to be quite big now and flowering. But if your friends are like, here's a chunk, take it now or leave it, those things are so hardy that I'm sure you'd have good success. Otherwise, I'd dig them in spring just as they're emerging, take a few pieces. And then again, just kind of if you can put them in a place where you could keep them contained, you'll be a lot happier down the road.
Okay, because they're really good for your blood system and your immune system to eat them.
Right, and I'm not trying to discourage you from a health standpoint. I just there's nothing worse than somebody recommending a plant and then not warning you, right?
Well, we've got lots of space, so we could fit one in here.
I just don't want you hating me in 10 years.
No. Thank you so much.
All right, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. We have David in Appleton with a question for you. Hi, David.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I want to let you know that I am a real big fan of Roundup First. That is
okay.
One of the best things I have used. I use it to reclaim a raspberry bed that I sprayed it on in the springtime before the canes leafed out, and it's been great ever since.
And I'm sorry, and you sprayed it on what was that again? I'm sorry.
It was a raspberry.
Oh, the raspberries. Okay, yeah.
Okay. And but my question, though, was someone had called earlier about green peppers and leaf drop, and I had a similar situation. I actually bought my peppers in the Madison area, and the gentleman that talked earlier was from that area, so I don't know where he got his plants from. But the ones that came from the nursery down there seem to have this leaf drop, but it doesn't seem to be a a viral type thing because there's new leaves still coming out.
And they're clean and they're healthy?
Yeah.
Now, are they dropping or curled?
No, they're just dropping.
One of the things that I saw a lot this year, because the weather, it seemed like it rained every weekend, and the garden centers, I noticed people shopping later than usual. I had a lot of my stuff kind of protected on my patio because it rained every time I had a couple hours to plant. I noticed a lot of leaf spot on things, and as soon as the plants got out in the garden, separated out, more space, not crammed on the shelves, more airflow, more light penetration, I noticed a lot less leaf drop, and I'm wondering if it's possible with the growing conditions and how plants kind of are packed in tight together, if that's a possibility. The weather getting a little warmer and drier, some of our disease patterns change as well. So you might want to, and moisture, consistent moisture is always
sure.
important too, not too wet, not too dry. So yeah. if new growth is coming out and you're starting to get some flowers set, then I wouldn't be too concerned. Just kind of keep an eye out for it. But I guess if it's just yellow, probably response to the weather. Spotted in yellow, it may have just been a leaf fungus, but you corrected the growing conditions or the weather improved in such a way that the disease wasn't a problem anymore.
Yep.
Sure.
There you go. Thanks, Dave.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Another Dave is in a community garden with minimal water for everybody. I have for roughly a month been using a retention pond for water. Will the vegetables take up the odor of mucky water? We have not had a lot of rain, and I water every other day.
My only concern, I wouldn't be so concerned about the odor in the vegetables, is just making sure there's no contaminants in that retention pond. Is the runoff coming, any pesticides coming in off of lawns or things like that? That would be my only concern. I think that's one of the nice things about a rain barrel. Having gardened at and managed community gardens that didn't have water access either, I feel your pain. Mulching is really a good thing when you water thoroughly, jugs with holes in the bottom, to slowly water is a good thing to do. You may just want to check with anyone that has information on, or take a look around the neighborhood and make sure nothing's going into that water that might be a toxin versus the smell. I wouldn't be too concerned about the smell, but more of, any issues with contaminants.
And Ellen in Boltonville says, on the 4th of July, with lots of people here, someone backed into, with their car, into my newly planted red bud.
Oh.
Gash about 3 or 4 inches vertical and about a good inch wide. Girth of the tree is about 2 to 2.5 inches. Should we be doing anything about the gash or just let it go?
Let it go, and that's the hardest thing. If there's any loose bark, you can carefully trim it. But when we start digging and gouging, we end up doing damage to the trunk, creating more openings for insects and disease. If we paint it, they found that traps more disease problems in and moisture in and causes problems. Only oak trees that are pruned during the growing season should be covered. So it's a matter of just leave it go. If the root system isn't mulched, create a nice mulch bed around it, get the grass back, water as needed thoroughly. Whenever the soil is slightly crumbly and moist, that's the best thing you can do.
And Sam in Superior, it's your turn. Hi, Sam.
Hi, Sam.
My question has to do with some Chinese cabbage that I'm growing. It's sure if it's forming a head right now, and there's some little flower-like things forming, and does that mean it's... I'm confused when I should harvest it and just what it's doing.
With the Chinese cabbage, it forms a very loose head. When you start seeing flowers, it's like with lettuce. When we get that hot weather moving in, a lot of our cool season crops like the Chinese cabbage often send up bloom and the flavor goes downhill. So if it's starting to flower, I'd harvest. Usually it's just when those leaves are like 10 or 12 inches tall and a loose head that you want to pick. I do a lot of my cooler season crops. I do a summer planting now for a fall harvest because I just seems like I can never, I'm never home or able to get things in the garden early enough. And by the time I do, we're already getting into hot weather, and that's what leads to the bolting. So you may want to do a second planting and do a harvest in the fall. The temperatures are cooler. The flavor is good. It, you know, not don't give it up on this one. I'd get out and harvest
sure.
it now. But you may want to do a second one as well. And I find a lot of people, you know, our weather is just so crazy here, and it can be cold and then all of a sudden hot. It's hard to often get those plants in early enough in the spring.
And Grace, who we talked with earlier, she mentioned we were talking about mulch with her. She wondered if you could more directly answer whether she can use cut-down irises as a mulch.
Okay. I'm sorry about that, Grace. If they weren't infected with any disease problem, sure. We just want to clean up our iris in the fall to prevent the iris borer from laying their eggs in the leaf litter, but that's more the dried up leaves on the plant creates a great place. But if you were to cut those iris and lay them down, you may want to put them around something else just to take care of, you know, avoid any yeah. concern. But yeah, as long as they're disease and insect free, you'd be fine.
And Debbie and Nina has a question for you. Hi, Deb.
Hi, how are you?
Good. Thanks for calling. What's on your mind?
I have a question. I have three hydrangea bushes. The old hydrangea questions all the time come up.
That's okay. It's a confusing group of plants.
I don't know what type it is. They were here when I moved in. They get a. They used to get nice blossoms on them that puffed up, and you know they would be blue or pink depending on what's
okay.
going on. Now they're just flat. They almost look like they turned into lace caps. They only get a few blossoms that open, and all the rest of them stay like tight little balls.
You know, I was doing some research, and Tim Woods is the breeder and plant explorer for Proven Winter Spring Meadow. And I'm trying to find out, you know, how common it is that hydrangeas revert. And that's what happens. Hydrangeas, the showy part, are the infertile flowers. So the big round with the puffy looking one have lots of infertile. The fertile flowers, the ones that can produce seeds, are those little nodule things that are, you know, often covered by the pretty ones or give the look of a lace cap. And I was trying to find out, you know, what's the cause. And in his one of his blogs, he was, I think it's called Plant Hunter's Blog or something like that. He was saying that he sees hydrangeas reverting and doesn't have a clue why that happens either. And I couldn't find any good evidence of what causes that. Sometimes plants mutate, sometimes a reaction to the environment. And so for some reason it's mutated and you're getting more fertile flowers that aren't showy and less of the sterile, infertile ones. If it's an old variety that was blue or pink, pink and alkaline blue and acid, you know, boy, one of the problems with those is, you know, if they're killed back in the winter, they bloom on old wood.
Yeah.
You know, so you get no flowers. Endless summer hasn't been performing the way we thought it would. Mine looks like I'm going to have a good set of blossoms, but I find when we get good rains in the spring, it has a good bloom season. And I'm not good at watering. You have to be kind of self-sufficient. So you may want to think of trying something different. Invincible Spirit and Bailey Nursery is coming out with a similar one. It's the Annabelle-type hydrangeas that are pink. They're pink no matter your soil pH. They bloom on new wood, so if they, you know, die back in the winter, they're fine. A couple inches the first year and about 6 inches in diameter by the third year. So you might want to check those out.
Melinda, thank you so much.
Thank you, Larry.
Great pleasure as always. And take a look at Melinda's website. It's melindamyers.com. She has a lot of great information on it. And great to have her with us, and thank you so much for listening, and I hope you'll stay with us. Lots more in store here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.